There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 238. With me today, I have David Squared, two Davids from StarCore Nuclear. David Dabney is the CEO and co-founder, and he's got a lot of industrial experience, including time with Alcoa and some Woodside Petroleum. And he's got a BS in mechanical engineering from Duke and an MBA from the Kellogg School. The other David is David Poole, who's the chief technical officer and co-founder of StarCore Nuclear, and he was a Royal Naval Test Pilot, graduated from the U.S. Naval Test Pilot School. David is a specialist in digital control systems. Welcome, David and David.
Well, thank you, Robin. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're very pleased to be here.
And I think the listeners will be able to tell David Dabney from David Poole, since David Dabney is the one who sounds like an American and David Poole doesn't.
David Poole sounds like an immigrant, but he's an American now.
Yes. So. Well, like I said, I didn't say you weren't an American. I just said you didn't sound like one. All right.
You're right.
So StarCore Nuclear is another entrant into the field of small modular power plant, nuclear power plants. It's one that has not been well publicized or understood yet, so we're going to try to overcome that issue. And so I'll let these two gentlemen tell me a little bit more about the company and when it was founded and where they're headquartered and what their plans for development are. I'll let you guys decide who to answer that question.
Well, we kind of do a tag team effort, and if we talk over one another, we'll try to keep that to a minimum. But David and I came from different backgrounds in terms of business, but have a mutual interest and concern, in particular, around climate change. I'm not sure that I would classify us as environmental activists as much as we are engineers and understand the issues involved and believe that there needs to be a lot done. And there are answers out there, and one of the answers clearly involves increasing nuclear. So David and I perchance met at boot camp at 5:30 in the morning a couple of years ago, which we still continue to this day. And we got into this discussion about the issue of, in particular, the increased use of coal as a base power load in so many of the emerging countries, and in particular at the time, China was the key developer, the most prominent. And David and I had a mutual interest in the idea that we could develop some alternative means of developing nuclear power to supply energy on a more equitable and reasonable scale to communities in need, and coming about it in a fashion that made both economic sense from an investment standpoint as well as economic sense from the end user standpoint. But most of all, it had to deliver power in a sensible manner and a safe and secure manner. And so that being the case, he and I talked around and both had a familiarity with Gen 4 technologies and specifically high-temperature gas reactors.
And that 2 years ago was actually 6 years ago now when we started this. We've been, David and I were both successful engineers in business when we both started companies, and they've both been acquired. I still work for the company that acquired mine. we put this all around. We looked at the variety of technologies, but we realized we had to have a business plan that worked. And this meant that we couldn't see ourselves selling into typical on-grid power in the United States. We didn't see any way to get this off the ground for 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Also, that the areas that we want to fix, we wanted to help, you know, 2.5 billion people without access to any power, 1.5 billion people without access to potable water. We call ourselves a civilized nation or civilization. It's just not right. So those are the people we wanted to help. It's meant going off the grid, which meant that our reactor had certain characteristics. And we started out with those as the core of our business plan and the requirements for our reactor. And what we've wound up with, which will be very familiar to you, Rod, is a high-temperature gas using chrysophyll. We actually use a prismatic core, which is the same that one that Areva used, and also it started with Fort San Varan in the United States, too, one of the two high-temperature gas plants that was produced over here. And we have a number of elements in our design that differentiate us, that allow us to take us off the grid, and effectively, when we get full qualification, to go to an unmanned 24/7 operation, fully automated plant. David?
So we talked about it and decided that even though we were both coming from outside the industry, that and it was extremely difficult because, as you know, Rod, because you've been in this space before and are well experienced in this area, that, you know, starting up a startup nuclear company, it's almost a contradiction in terms. But the fact that you start from scratch and you're going into a heavily regulated, as it should be, environment to then bring not a new technology, but an alternative technology in a different application to the market is extremely difficult. But we decided that, all things considered, that it was something we really needed to make a serious attempt at. So we've been at it for 6 years, as David said, since September of 2008, and we've come a long way, quite a distance. We've gone through a lot of work from the technical end of the spectrum to get the initial concept outlined and if you will, tested or reviewed in front of physicists and nuclear experts from around North America as well as some international. And then we spent an inordinate amount of time collecting market data to then be able to deliver what we consider to be a pure investment-grade opportunity, one where we are attempting to bring this to market without having to go for government support, without having to require government support. And we recognize that that is not a bad thing, but we didn't want to encumber the opportunity to then bring this to market. And we're certainly not averse to it, and we would apply for the programs that make sense for StarCorps and so forth, around grants and other opportunities, but we're keenly focused on the idea that we want to bring something to market that then has an attractiveness in terms of its safety and security foremost, but also then would bring to the potential investors a significant and healthy return for the risk that they're taking on.
The safety side, I know that you know how this works, Bob, but the listeners may not. What happens in a high-temperature gas, the typical operating temperature of the core, exit temperature is between 750 and 850 Celsius, and as if you shut off the helium or fail to use the reactivity controls, just total disaster. The temperature will roll up to 1,100 degrees or so. Newfound energy levels will go up, and after they get about 10 to the 5th electron volts, they no longer start to cause fission, or the fission rate in uranium-235 decays rapidly. So in the end, when the temperature goes up, the whole core goes into stasis, and it stabilizes at a temperature. At a temperature well below the safe limits of the core fuel, which is encased in three layers. That's why it's called tristructural isotropic. And the fuel is now qualified up to 1850 Celsius. And so the highest temperature we're likely to see is around 1200, 1250, even in any hotspots. So we've got a huge safety margin. And if everything goes wrong with the core, that all the reactivity controls, all the coolant shuts down, it'll still be 500, 600 degrees away from any
potentially catastrophic event. It'll just sit there. And our core makes about as much energy as a couple of SUV engines. You know the size of the radiators on those. And we radiate any of this thermal energy into the surrounding subsoil because our reactors are buried in silos below the isotropic level. And that's typically how the thing works. Now, we've got a couple of other wrinkles in our design. One of the things that we set out in our requirements that we didn't want, reflections of Avatar, we didn't want any unobtainium in our design. We didn't want to get into a big R&D program to get our first reactors on the ground. So we are using two stages of energy transfer. The first stage is helium out of the core, then we go through IHX1, the first stage heat exchanger, then we go into nitrogen at a very similar pressure. Now, the reason we do that is because we want to use a compact heat exchanger here, and they're quite, I don't say fragile, but we don't want to see a big delta P, delta pressure, across the boundaries of it. So then we go into nitrogen, we take the nitrogen into another heat exchanger, which is in a classical air-breathing gas turbine, the same sort of things that you see on the little puddle jumpers, with propellers on the front of the gas turbines, but we have a generator on the front there. And so we have standard technology that everybody understands all the way through our plant. We're not going into helium gas turbines or anything like that. And this also gives us the ability to be fully load following, so we can follow anybody's loads, however fast they are. Our plant has two states. It's either in load following, it's shut down. And when it's in the load following plant, we have an automated control system that we've actually developed for space operations and we'll use widely in the space industry for launch vehicles and spacecraft control, both from low Earth orbiting out to deep space. And it's owned, the technology, the intellectual property is owned by the other company that I work for, which I'm CTO. And they've given StarCore the right to use the IP for nuclear control because they believe in this concept too. David?
Yeah, Rob, one of the things that we focused on was that in terms of the size, ours is a 10 megawatt electric, 5 megawatt thermal, with the 5 megawatt thermal, but 35 megawatt thermal overall, nominal output. And when we went to look at this, because of the fact that we're focused on the off-grid market, we wanted to then be able to bring in such a size and scope that we could address the needs of what we saw with the range of opportunities in terms of off-grid communities. So in the on-grid market, it probably doesn't make sense until you're up at about 100 megawatts electric output. But when we surveyed the environment, both in terms of Canada, where we're starting the business, Australia, where there's a big need for remote power, and then, of course, a lot of the third world countries where they're either based on diesel or, in some cases, wood or cow dung or whatever that might be in terms of heating and cooking and general electricity and general power, we found that this particular size, 10 megawatt electric increments, where you can have from 1 to 6 cores within an operating plant, was generally met those needs quite substantially, and that we could then mix the output in terms of heat and power delivering benefits beyond just the electricity to then provide other opportunities in the community for, as is most often the case, fresh water, district heating, greenhouse agriculture, and if it's an industrial environment, and the heat and power, of course, can be combined in any number of ways in terms of the materials and minerals processing that we typically have in industrial locations.
Okay, so let me break in.
Trying to then hone that in. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, let me break in for a minute here on the power output. Your machine's a load following machine, so if you're supplying a fairly isolated area where the power demand cycles over the course of the day, you may give up a little efficiency, but it probably isn't much of a problem for your machine to operate well below its rated power for.
Well, that's true. We can offer it down to 2 megawatts of electricity, Rod, and we could also put out thermal energy. We switch between the two. So some locations, like at least some of their requirements are to generate or at least to desalinate water overnight when there's not much demand of electricity and there's no sun, so they can't use solar energy to do the same. And a lot of the industrial areas we've been looking at like to have a nice flexible mix of electricity and thermal energy. David just mentioned one interesting fact that I think it's below our radar in the Western world, is that a few years ago, the World Health Organization stated that the biggest cause of worldwide death was quite surprising to me. It was emphysema from indoor smoke, from inhalation, from cooking and heating. And I was just staggered to hear that, just staggered. There's clearly a lot we need to do for all of the developing nations and all the people in our world. And we believe our plant can do it. That's why we've actually set out the requirements, and that's why it's designed the way it is.
Okay, now, I was going to say, you know, your business model is going to be, as described in your website, a build, own, operate, and decommission. So you will remain or your company will remain responsible for the power plant and then sell the electricity. Have I got that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
that's right. You know, looking at the small communities, there's no way that they can come up with the money or the organization to get a license and run a plant. So we've taken that burden off the table for them, rather.
Yeah. So will you also be involved in building the distribution grid that will move your electricity to the homes that are currently burning dung indoors?
Yes, we're going to build the local grid. It'll be a smart grid. We actually generate, the design for our generator is to generate a synchronous AC so we can allow the turbines to run up, spool up and down in speed. Invert it so we're now back at synchronous AC, and then we put that into a smart grid. If we want to interface with any other generating units around the same site, supposing there's some sort of solar or wind on site too, we don't want to be dragged around by any difficulties they may have in maintaining synchronous power. So we can put a DC link into them, and you're probably aware that there's all sorts of high voltage DC technology available nowadays. So we also have in our standard small plant 2 10-megawatt reactors, and that is to provide backup because we're quite aware that if we're in a location that's up in the far north, we have a big responsibility to make sure that the power's there 24/7, 365. Otherwise, people are going to die.
You feel as though the build, own, operate, licensing, and then decommissioning of the facility provides the opportunity for a lot of these areas that don't have access to power, because as you all know, no matter what the infrastructure arrangement is, once you then put in some sort of power infrastructure, it requires such a substantial undertaking in terms of not only the federal government, the state level government, local governments, and that sort of thing, and financing and so forth becomes so complex. And so we wanted to then eliminate the barriers to entry in terms of for the communities that we can service. So the idea was that if we could then comprise this in basically a long-term power purchase agreement, where we would then provide the combination of heat power as desired by the community, it made it much easier for us to then manage it from our end. And effectively, as you know, Rob, with an FMR, once you get down to the nth of a kind build and that sort of thing, then the ability to then replicate that and put that sort of package together becomes more and more viable, as you will. The challenge, of course, will be, as everyone is aware in the SMR community, will be building the first one to whatever the folk number is that's required to then get the process, if you will, in place. But once that's in place, then it creates a market opportunity out there where we see that we can really then reach out and go beyond just North America. So the idea that one of the primary reasons that we focused on Canada was that the felt as though they had a process and procedures in place specifically to address the differences with SMRs as opposed to large-scale reactors, PWRs, and the fact that they had a precedent in terms of developing the CANDU reactors and then exporting that to six or seven other countries, several of which did not have nuclear regimes in place. And so they had the international recognition and the precedent in terms to take a different technology to other countries where the need for power is just as great, if not greater, than in places like North America.
Okay, so how far away are you from filing a license application with the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission?
Well, maybe we could just have a little bit more background, Rod. We had a big technical review meeting, which is what we call them in Starcar, TRM, and we had one as well as at Argonne National Labs. This was maybe 2.5 years ago, David. And we invited the leading nuclear physicists and specialist engineers and regulators from around the world, from INL, ANL, CNSC at the time, AECL, and of course IAEA. And we had a very successful meeting. It came out with, I think, about 3 points that we took to CNSC as critical elements that we had to have agreement that we could make some progress with if we were going to be successful. The two of the most important ones was one, that we would establish the nuclear boundary at the surface of the trisomicrosphere. Now, this is 0.93 millimeters in diameter, and it contains all of the fissile products, as you're well aware, Rod. So we have on the table, that is our primary nuclear boundary. Our secondary boundary is the helium pressurization system, and the third boundary is the silos that the reactor is contained within. So it's an extremely robust design. It has one entire layer of additional protection over any of the other plants in the world. And also the primary layer at the surface of the microsphere is very, very robust, very robust. You can't have a failure of all of them like you can in a standard PWR. The other topic that we took to CNSC is that we wanted to go to fully automated control with no operators on site. Now, this sounds a little bit, I don't know, scary to some people when we start, but I think that nowadays it would be difficult for you to get into an elevator that had an operator. You wouldn't be exactly reassured if it was. And you know, you jump in those trains that take you around the airports all the time. They don't have any operators. We have a very robust automation system, and our reactor itself, designed itself, is inherently safe. So we had that meeting. We then, last year, we invited to join the Next Generation Nuclear Plant Alliance, Industry Alliance, which was a big step for us. Canada nominated us as the representative at the International Atomic Energy Authority for HTGR SMRs. And we went to several meetings over there on this topic. And we have agreements with the major supply companies in terms of the core design, the core fabrication, all of the core materials and the fuel. So we're ready to go in terms of technical design at the moment. So we are about, I don't know, David, you've got the schedules there, 9 months away, I think, from our initial VDR application. Is that right?
We're going. Yeah, that's right. We're the process with the CNSC, Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, is one where they allow you to have a pre-licensing review. And David and I and several people working with us have met with the CNSC on a couple of occasions to map out our licensing process with them. They have a prescribed process, but they allow you this pre-licensing review, which is voluntary, and we elected to undergo that as a starting point because of the fact that we wanted to then be able to present some of the initial information related to the differences in our design, such as the idea around the zero nuclear boundary and a couple of other items. And they have agreed to that, and so we will we'll actually start the pre-licensing review with them in the third quarter of this year, and then we will embark upon the licensing probably about 12 months to 18 months after that.
Okay.
And the first plant is, according to our detailed schedule, well, the first plant goes in the ground and actually comes online in 2020.
Okay. Are you going to build the first plant in Canada?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. First plant goes in Canada.
We'll build the first several plants in Canada. It'll be, the idea is that although we are keenly intend to deliver this to other locations where the need is greater, we recognize the fact that we have to start at in a country with an internationally recognized authority that has all of the checks and balances required in terms of the most stringent and strictest regimes possible. But we believe that then once we do that, we can create basically our export passport for the technology and be able to take it to other locations. There'll still be plenty of complexities involved. It doesn't make it easier per se, but it fulfills a lot more of the requirements at the start. And so we're keenly focused there, starting in Canada, at least as a minimum, probably three operations in Canada before we would then start to look to export to other countries.
Now, I'm not sure if you all would find this important, but is the first unit going to be close to your engineering group in physical?
The way that the initial units are going to work is that we have contracts out, statements of work out, all the major suppliers, and they're going to be building the elements for us for the first plants. We take over that as the plants mature and we get experience with the first plants running. The first ones are the Alpha series. We expect to build two or three of those. They are going to be, all of the plants are going to be nominally identical, but of course we're going to be being able to take anything that we learn and roll those back into our production-like capabilities. This is a bit alien to the nuclear industry in general, as you know, because typically every plant is uniquely designed, which is not good for long-term quality assurance and making sure that all of the knowledge goes back into the plants. But all of our plants are going to be identical. I said with minor variations, just like you see a slight update to cars that are built on the production line, and we'll be doing the same.
Yeah, one of the things that has always distressed me a little bit about the traditional method of designing and building and operating nuclear plants is that I've run into a number of nuclear engineers who've worked for design companies for their whole career without so much as stepping foot inside an operating nuclear power plant. It just never made sense to me that they could be a designer of something that they never saw operating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm with you absolutely.
And one of the
it's
other
certainly strange.
One of the other concepts that I've tried to promote, and it sounds like you all have already adopted it, is the idea that the way you achieve economy of scale, if you're going to have smaller units, is to manage those units as a fleet. So that if you have changes, you have one group that makes changes. You have one group that writes all the procedures and writes all of the emergency operating procedures and the maintenance procedures for all of the units because they're all the same.
Yeah, and that's a very good point.
That's right.
Yes, we have a central control concept, StarCore Central, and we have satellite links from all our plants back to the StarCore Central. We actually run three links back. Two of them are geosynchronous satellites, which gives us 24/7 full-time wide bandwidth link back again. And we have, since they're geosynchronous, we can pick one in the eastern hemisphere for each plant and one in the western hemisphere. They're kind of looking in different directions. So we have two antennas. And third light, we have a vertical link up to the low Earth orbiting satellites, which are not continuous, but they come across on a regular basis. And that allows us to do a final backup if all of the geosynchronous links go out. One of the other things that came
of great interest to us when we were looking around what remote communities need in the world. You know, they need power, they need water, but the other thing they need is wide bandwidth links so they can get education and medical help too. So we're going to distribute a tunneled internet link from the general internet down through to these communities. Now, it doesn't go anywhere near control links. The control links are separate, and this is, if you like, a virtual tunnel that goes through them. We submitted our design for the control system complete, together all the links and the security that we had in it, to CNSC, and they actually commissioned a review by Atomic Energy Canada Limited, which is now Canadian Nuclear Laboratories, and they gave us a They not only gave us a clean bill of health at a major conference, they stood up and said STARCOR has gone several levels beyond the minimum that would be required to run a nuclear reactor by a remote link. And the actual terminology we use is the plant is fully automated with remote intervention. So we don't actually control it by the link, that's local, but we can shut it down by the remote link. And we can monitor it, of course, too. And as you said, that gives us the ability to concentrate all of our technology and operational procedures and experience in one place. And you and many of the listeners are probably aware that Three Mile Island that occurred in the United States, they had an identical incident some months before in a different one of their sister plants. And the operators in Three Mile Island had no idea that it had happened or how they'd fixed it. Just terrible. That's not going to happen to us, Rod.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. One of my very frequent commenters on Atomic Insights is a man named Mike Derivan, who was the shift supervisor at Davis-Besse in September 1977, when they had what we, the two of us, called the first 20 minutes of Three Mile Island. He is the guy who figured out what the problem was, how to fix it, and he, to this day, is still on a mission to clear the names of the operators, because he said they did exactly what they were trained to do. The problem is that the people who trained them didn't know what was going to happen when you had a steam space leak. And so they trained them incorrectly. And, of course, he also...
All the experts they brought in to figure it out, too, they didn't actually help either.
Well, they weren't experts,
yeah.
First of all. They were...
They
were something, but they weren't experts. The second thing is that he's also quite angry that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which was at that time the only group that got all of the incident reports, had no process for disseminating those incident reports back out to interested or responsible people. So they knew all about Davis-Besse. They just never told all the other operators of the same plant about the problem.
Yeah, terrible. Yeah.
Okay, so...
Very unfortunate.
All right, I'm sure that there's going to be questions about security. If you're talking about remote operations of and automated operations, how are you going to protect your plants from those who might want to do damage to it or try to gain access to the nuclear materials, whatever? I don't have that big a question about it, but I'm sure other people will. So I'll let you explain.
David, do you want to tackle this one?
Yeah, sure. The first thing, of course, is the application of the high-temperature gas reactor technology, which is recognized, of course, through the International Atomic Energy Agency as inherently safe. And so that's a starting point. That's the most critical point, and that's what drove us to then choose that technology specifically. And the fact that it is not a new technology, it's a proven technology. Plants have been built and operated in other places, in the United States and other places around the world. But then we took that, and David and I specifically decided that we needed to then enhance the safety and security of that inherent safety and then add other aspects to it, even at the expense of operating efficiency. So the idea of going from helium to nitrogen to air breathing was so that we could mitigate the potential for pressure loss or helium loss across the pascal boundary in the heat exchangers. We then put the core in a silo, which is then below ground level, and the helium loop is essentially totally segregated out from the rest of the operation. The silos are double-walled concrete silos, high-strength concrete silos, and effectively you could essentially take out the entire operation above ground, you know, whether it were environmental, terrorist, or otherwise, and it would then basically go into its stasis mode, whereby the operation has certain effects where it can then deploy rods to then slow the operation down, or effectively you're not worried about the fact that you're going to release radiation to the atmosphere. Sorry,
and that's our beyond design basis accident, Rod, is that a terrorist squad comes in and blows everything above ground flat. The actual reactor pressure vessel is something like 120 tons, and that's again, somewhere between 25 and 60 meters down in the ground, depending upon the actual terrain we're putting it into. There are no winches or cranes on the site. And you know what an RPV is made out of, nuclear-grade stainless. Hello?
Oh, go ahead,
It's extremely tough. The whole concept is based on a concept that actually was brought in by a Canadian who was looking at deploying nuclear power up in the far north. Now, whatever gang of security or people that you actually bring in to protect the site, you can always imagine a scenario where you have more. It's difficult to imagine you could actually stop a determined SWAT team getting in if they wanted to. But getting the reactor out, it would be extremely difficult. And it would take them some days, even if they actually flew in cranes or something like that. And when you've got it out, what have you got? You've got this big steel vessel, and inside it you have the core and these small granules. When you've finally got all of the core apart and taken the fuel compacts apart, and they're extremely tough. All of the microspheres are extremely tough. It's a very difficult proposition to turn a crisofueled reactor into any sort of nuclear catastrophe. Very difficult. It would take a lot and a lot of determination, a lot of organization, and a good deal of industry to do it. And we just don't think it's a viable event for anybody to attack one of these and expect to get away with it before federal authorities come in and stop them. And that's the general concept, that you can't. If you really do a total analysis of it, you can never stop the most determined team getting in, but they're certainly not going to do any damage to the reactor, and they're not going to get away before you can actually can stop them from getting away. So we've got something like a 48-hour boundary between any attack and the time that they could even start tinkering with our reactors.
The RPV itself inside the silo has several lids, each of which is several tons each, and then we don't actually locate cranes at the site of the operation. They are only come in when we do replacing the cores. But otherwise, it's inaccessible. There's no back door, and there's no, you know, special way to get down there. You have to remove all the hatches to get to the cores, and the cores have to be pulled out. It's very, very, very difficult. Extremely difficult.
Okay, so
and we're immune to seismic events, and we also can be hit by the largest of the civil airliners if somebody flew it into the site, and would survival of that do run?
Well, it's also hard to fly a civilian airline vertical. You can't have a vertical attack profile from a civilian aircraft. So do you envision having anybody on site at all?
Yes. There's going to be two classes of people. One will be kind of general maintenance people to make sure that that any of the oil reservoirs for the turbines are filled up, that the diesel is there for our backup generators, that sort of general low-level maintenance. And also there are going to be local people from the community responsible to the local community for the power distribution and what they do with the power. The plant is fully automated there itself.
So ultimately we do hope to get to an operation with out requiring operators on site, and we had designed the facility such that in the longer term that we would then allow public access to the front part of the building and using, as you can imagine, Rob, for the bandwidth that we use, we have an extreme bandwidth, but we actually only need a small portion of it, an extremely small portion of it. And so due to the nature of the design of that satellite communication system, we can then provide other opportunities in terms of education or telemedicine or other things that would help the provide some basic needs to the local communities as well.
Okay, so the facility is going to be a very good neighbor to have and welcome to the communities, right?
Yes, good neighbor, yes, exactly. Good looking. Totally safe, absolutely. And the other point is that if you look around decommissioning sites, it's sometimes very difficult. I know there's a lot of regulations about it, but it's sometimes difficult to point a finger and say this group or this company is a responsible agent for decommissioning the site when it's all done. That's not going to happen in our case. StarCorp takes that responsibility. We have it in our business plan, and we built it into our financial models too. And we think it's the only morally correct thing to do. If you're a nuclear company, you're building nuclear power plants, and you're installing them around the world, you better be responsible for decommissioning them too.
Exactly. We want to know that we can then provide that long-term vision of the fact that this will, once they decide that they need to remove it, that it can be removed. And in certain applications, certain like mining operations and remote industrial operations, that could often be the case. In communities, they may want to then continue to use it, which is, or renew the relationship or whatever that may be. We're happy to do that. But we want to be a responsible party. And so, one of the aspects is that we really want to change the paradigm that we just throw electricity over the fence. We really want to change the paradigm. Energy is a basic need. It's one of the basic things in terms of food, shelter, safety, security that people look for as a basic. And so we want to be able to then say, okay, we're in at that level, then they're going to actually be more than just an energy provider.
Okay, so how long would you expect your installations to last?
The nominal time is 25 years, but we expect to, with experience, that to extend up to 40 years. We actually replace the core fuel in a cartridge form. At the moment, our expectation is every 8 years. It might get longer than that, but that's what we're looking at. So during the life of the plant, every 8 years, we come and replace the cores. And that goes on for 25 years at the moment. We're looking for 25-year power purchase agreements, which is actually how we fund the plants, as you probably, I think you already understand that.
So we've actually done some proposals to various locations, and they've asked for different time frames. One asked for 40 years, but generally in terms of power needs, 25 years is not that unusual or obscure, if you will. So that pretty much is a desired outcome in terms of being able to supply power for the long term.
Okay,
and
so
carbon footprint that we take out is just huge. You know that all of these remote sites are burning either Arctic diesel, if they're far north, or diesel. Some of them are burning bunker C oil, which is really the nastiest stuff you can actually get your hands on. Many of the mines, at least most of the mines, and all of the uranium mines, are burning huge quantities of propane, which they use for ventilation of the mines, because, of course, the mines have radon in them, and they have to continuously blow warm air through the lines to ventilate it. Just huge carbon footprints we can take out here, Rob, so as well as bringing all the benefits. So we think it's time to... I'm going
to
get on with this.
If you map the island nations around the world, the vast majority of them are burning bunker C because it's the least expensive form of fuel around. It's also probably one of the worst pollutants in terms of other than coal, because of the heavy metals and other materials, salt, SOx, and NOx that it involves. And but even though they're burning the cheapest fuel around, the price of the actual cost of energy in most of those island nations is 2x to 10 times what we currently pay in places like North America and Europe. And so Bermuda, which is beautiful and pristine and so forth, their retail price of energy is about 52 cents a kilowatt hour and going up, and they're burning bunker shoes. And they're collecting rainwater off their roof, and the stack is then putting out, you know, not far from it. And that's not unusual. That's just an example. But if you go into the South Pacific countries, it's the same thing, but they often then can only provide power to the communities nearby for a couple hours in the morning and a couple hours in the afternoon because it's so expensive.
It's interesting that you mentioned Bermuda. One of the inspiring times that I started development of Adams Atomic Engines was in after a 1991 cruise to Bermuda, when my wife and I visited the island. We even took a tour of the power plant down there because I had just finished my tour as a engineering officer on board a submarine, and I couldn't believe the amount of oil that was being burned on the cruise ship and the amount of oil being burned to power the island. So that leads me to the next question. Do you have any vision of your a version of your power plant being available to power ships? Which
well, that's
also
a good question, Rob, but one of the trade-offs for the different types of nuclear technology is energy density. And some just throwing some numbers around it, like orders of magnitude. And the numbers are not exactly right. They're a little bit off. It's exactly order of magnitude. But if you look at high-temperature gas, we're looking at around about 7 megawatts per cubic meter. If you go to pressurized water reactors, you're an order of magnitude higher than that, around 60, 70 megawatts. If you go into a fast reactor, you're looking at another order of magnitude, that's 500 to 700 megawatts cubic meter. Now, the difficulty with marine power plants, at least in the smaller ships, is the sheer size of high-temperature gas. The larger ones, it'll fit very nicely indeed. But we don't expect to be kind of ubiquitous in terms of the smaller vessels. It's my guess, if we look at the general course of development over time, high-temperature gas is going to be a wonderful staple for the foreseeable future. If we need to get any higher density, then some of the other technologies are very attractive, you know, like liquid metal-cooled reactors, lead, bismuth, eutectic, sodium reactors. All of those have many advantages, including increased power density, but they all have this major disadvantage that somebody has to build them and get them regulated, actually get approval for them. And there's lots of materials that need to be developed. Lead bismuth eutectic plants are attractive. Those were the plants that actually the Russians used in the Alpha class submarines, which always amused me a bit. I know this is a kind of slightly cynical view of it all, but these were small attack class submarines that featured in Red October, I think. Anyway, they were made of titanium. They're very small and fast. They had lead-cooled power plants. Now, the big difficulty about lead-cooled power plant is if you get cold, the whole thing goes solid lead, and there's no way you can start it up again. You can't heat it up again to keep it going. So you've got to keep the lead hot. Now, of the 12 submarines they built, they had extensive facilities when they came into harbor to keep the plants hot. But it was interesting when I discovered how many of those plants went solid. And 8 of them went solid. When a nuclear lead plant goes solid, the only thing you can do is saw it up for scrap and dispose of it. You can't get it going again. So, and their submarines were made of titanium. They couldn't get them open. They were in a heap of trouble. I think some of these plants are very attractive technology. A little down the road, when we have got the idea that nuclear power is viable again, everybody can see the advantages of it, and we can actually start, if you like, nuclear R&D programs, which I don't think that anybody's going to look at the moment. The great thing about high-temperature gas, it's been around since the 40s. The British built three Dragon plants back in the 50s and 60s. Germany built several plants. South Africa almost got a plant going, but failed because of political considerations. Two plants here in the United States, lots of plants being built in China, and a ton of experience with high-temperature gas and tri-structural isotropic fuel. And so we are ready to go, and we don't think that licensing is going to be a challenge for us. And other plants, later.
I will challenge the power density notion, because what counts to me is the power density of the entire plant, not the power density of just the reactor core. And when you compare it to a steam plant, people often think about the power density of the core. They forget about how much other metal and material is required to have a steam plant operating compared to a gas turbine.
Yes, well, certainly true. Absolutely. Yeah. Steam plants are difficult, yeah. as you well aware. You've got lots of experience with those, I know, Rob.
Yeah, and, you know, Rob, one of the things that we see in terms of the HPGR technology is that from a bring-to-market standpoint, it is the one that is most likely, the most commercially viable at this time. It is a proven technology, and it's one that has been tested and put into the market. So we see this as then what would be then the tipping point, the ability to then invest in nuclear in a logical, sensible manner, one that does not then create excessive investments and cost overruns and that sort of thing. And the SMR concept is based on that basic concept. You take that, then you create this recognition that you can then build safe nuclear facilities. And that then enhances the financial community to then look at the other technologies that are out there, so that there's a synergistic effect around improving and proving a lot of the other technologies that are not then yet commercially developed. And we want that. I mean, we believe as a fundamental that nuclear is not the answer, but it should be a bigger part of the energy answer. It has a much larger role than we recognize today, and we have to be realistic about that. So we want to then create the venue and the opportunity for these other technologies to be brought on in a sensible manner. And unless there's some means to then prove that it's viable and financially reasonable at the start, then the financial markets will always hesitate from investing in that, because the horizons will be too far out.
So
yeah, and David makes a good point. You know, there's so many things that are below the kind of the event horizon for the everyday people. They're busy with their lives, they're getting on with things. They think that they don't fully understand, they don't know. There's no information out there that all of these remote plants, power plants, are burning carbon everywhere. And it would be easy to say, well, we're just going to put in a big nuclear power plant and string some transmission lines and get the power to there. But that's not easy. The transmission lines, as you're aware, it's billions of bucks to put in a long-distance transmission line, billions of dollars. And somebody's going to have to pay for their cost. And there's a few communities at the other end, they're certainly not going to get any help to do it. And yet they're going to be stuck with no power and emphysema and burning carbon. We have to do something about it. And the only viable answer is nuclear. Wind and solar certainly have their place, but they come and go in remote communities. Now, if we had a kind of a huge grid around the whole Earth, so we could use solar energy in one side of the Earth to support the nighttime requirements from the other side, that would be fine, but that's not going to happen. We just can't ship the power out that easily.
Well, it to me, it's not even worth talking about, because the infrastructure costs are enormous. The losses that you would have are enormous.
Enormous too.
Diffuse power requires very large collectors, and those large collectors, no matter where you locate them, are going to be idle for about 70% of the time.
Those numbers are right on for it. And
idle capital is just not useful. I mean, it's a particularly when it's materially intensive idle capital. That's just not a smart thing to do. And so I like compact systems, and I like the idea of putting the systems near the people that are going to need them. Sounds to me like your technology would be amenable to the idea, even a community that doesn't have any initial need for the amount of power you produce. Our experience in the world is once people have access to power, they start figuring out more and more ways to use it, as long as it's not too costly or too dangerous or consumes too many of their local resources. So, you may put in a power plant initially and not have quite enough customers, but hey, you may actually go out and market your electricity and say, we've got it, come and buy it.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah.
You know, part of our business model is that for each power plant we put in, we install a local utility company that's based in the town, and it's actually, it belongs to the town. And that utility company will be giving zero interest loans out to start-up businesses in the town. So, because we want to promote their business too, and promote the viability of their communities to use the power. So, yep, all of the good things we can do here, I think.
All right, so where does somebody buy stock in StarCore Nuclear?
Well, as you can imagine, we would love to be selling stock at this point, and that's in the plans, but the initial phase right now is we're actually, we developed a model and specifically targeted at getting direct investment in it, direct investors, and so we're now in the phase of the capital raising for our Series A, and we've had a certain amount of success so far, and we anticipate that we'll be able to close on the Series A round here within the next probably 2 to 3 months. And it's been surprising to us because, as you probably know, Rod, we went through a lot of praying for rain in the desert for a while there, but we've now then come to the point where, both due to the interest in other energy means of delivering energy,
David said we were calling a lot of people. We've got quite a good group down here at StarCore, including our nuclear engineering director has spent his life in the nuclear industry, and he started at Fort St. Brian in a high temperature gas. Our director of finances. But we, for a long time, we were calling people and they weren't calling back. But now people have started to call us. And so, as David said, we expect to close in the next 3 months to get enough funding to get our first reactor in the ground.
Okay, so on the off chance that somebody with money is listening to this podcast, how can they get in touch with one or the two of you or your CFO?
Well, they can actually contact us directly. It's david.dabney@starcorenuclear.ca or david.poole@starcorenuclear.ca. We're a Canadian company, so it is a .ca. And we're happy to entertain. We have a complete electronic data room with not just a business plan and a financial plan, but a whole series of technical reports, operating plans, implementation plans, risk mitigation plans. We've spent quite a bit of time developing this data room in extensive detail to then address the needs of the investor, and specifically to then be able to dial it down so that we have our risks literally identified in various stages. We've set up a stage gate process in terms of the implementation around that, and to then recognize each one of the risk profiles and then the optimum type of investment vehicles available for each stage of the process.
And as David said, this is an investment-grade project. This isn't technology looking for home. We show very healthy returns to our investors, and we realize we must do to start up nuclear. So if anybody would like to talk to us at greater length, we'd be very happy to look at that and support that discussion. That would be wonderful.
Okay. And for those of you who are simply interested in technology and maybe don't have the cash to get involved in something like this, because I imagine it would be a very accredited type investor who could get in a stage A round. The exactly. website address yeah. is Starcore Nuclear. That's all one word, everything spelled conventionally, .ca, starcorenuclear.ca. Pretty good website, has a lot of these the details that we talked about today. I want to thank both of you for taking the time to share your vision with the Atomic Show audience, and I wish you the best of luck. I hope that I hear more from you in the near future as you make progress. Will you be attending any upcoming conferences where people can meet you face to face?
We're interested in attempting the getting to the Charlotte meeting that's happening here in North America, but because as you can imagine, because we're in the fundraising phase right now, in terms of the Series A, our time has been a little bit tied up, as you can imagine. we've been doing quite a few road shows, as they call them, but that being the case, we're happy to meet with people. The Charlotte one's probably most likely in the near future, but we're not sure of our schedule 100% at this point.
And we have a Facebook page if anybody wants to go on that, and you're welcome to comment or ask questions. We'll be delighted to interface with you.
Absolutely.
Great. All right. Well, thank you both. Have a good day.
Okay. Thanks again, Rod.
Thanks so much, Rod. Appreciate it.
Once again, a reminder, the Atomic Show podcast is a value for value proposition. I bring it to you, and if you think it's worthwhile, you provide a donation contribution to the show. You can do that by visiting atomicinsights.com and clicking on the donate button. Thanks to all those who have contributed already. And I'm going to ask a polling question here. If you think that there would be more response or there would be a desire for people to have their contributions thanked publicly, acknowledged on the air, please let me know. We're considering implementing that as part of the value proposition for those who want to proclaim proudly that they are sponsors of the Atomic Show and Atomic Insights. Thank you all for your attention. Bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.